A talk on judging others was given abroad. Our Lord left us a very great and solemn commandment: judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged. The Holy Gospel also says that the Father has entrusted judgment to the Son, and the Son says, judge not, that you be not judged. Yet we human beings take upon ourselves the judgment that belongs to the Son of God, and we judge one another. And as we know, the root of condemnation is human egotism. At the root of egotism, this incurable disease, from which a person is not easily freed, is something deeply embedded in the human heart. It is an inheritance that we human beings received from our forefather Adam, who resisted God, spoke against him, and did not obey his commandment. We know very well the account in the Old Testament concerning the five cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Because of the exceedingly great sin of those five cities, God punished them and submerged them, and what is called the Dead Sea came into being. This sea, this great lake, contains sulfur and is called dead because no life exists within it. Whatever flows into it from the other rivers, especially from the Jordan, dies. The five cities lie lost beneath its depths. As the people sinned, the stench of their sin rose up to God. The stench rose up to God, and God said, I will go down and see whether the people truly live according to the stench coming from those five cities, whether they are indeed sinning. As God, he already knew that the stench was rising, yet he said, I will go down and learn whether it is truly so. Here God gives us an example. Even when we hear certain things that do not seem right to us, actions, deeds, or words that appear wrong, we should not be quick to judge unless we have seen them with our own eyes or examined the matter for ourselves. And even if we do see something, we may still be deceived and interpret it wrongly. How much more so, when we merely hear something, do not examine it, and simply agree with it? In this way, one person passes the infection of condemnation on to another. God said that he would go down and see whether the people of the five cities were truly living so sinfully. When the Jews caught a woman in the very act of adultery, they brought her before Christ and said to him, seeking, of course, to trap him, this woman was caught in the act of sin. The Mosaic law says that such women must be stoned. What do you say? Then Christ bowed his head and wrote on the ground, and he said, let him who is without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her. Then he bent down again and continued writing. When he lifted his head again and looked, he said to her, woman, has no one condemned you? No one, Lord. One by one they had slipped away, and they left her there alone with the Lord. When he saw that they had all gone, for their consciences convicted them that they were not without sin and had no right to pick up a stone, throw it at her and kill her. The Lord said to her, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. All this enables us to understand how grave a sin it is to judge our neighbor. It is an exceedingly grave sin. We find examples in Holy Scripture and in patristic tradition of certain saints who, through carelessness, fell into the sin of condemnation and were punished very severely by God. And one cannot help but say, if these holy people were punished so severely by God because once or twice a word or thought escaped them and they judged someone, then if this is what happens to the green wood, what will happen to the dry? What then will happen to us who are so quick to condemn our neighbor? Many times we make mistakes. Without examining a matter, we interfere and pass judgment, and afterward we do not even realize how we have sinned. If we knew, at least we could put that sin through the refining furnace of holy confession, so that it might be taken away. But thoughts and words of condemnation slip past us, and we do not even realize it so that we can wipe them away. Then tomorrow we will stand before the judgment seat, and when all these things are set before us, we will say, but how did this happen? How did so many things accumulate? We see this in the account known as the life of Saint Theodora. As she passed through the aerial toll houses, she was terrified by the demon's detailed examination. They had everything recorded with complete precision, even the time and the persons involved. Her soul shuddered at the exactness of the account, and if she had not received the help of the prayers of Saint Basil, she would not have been saved. She would not have passed through the toll houses, for the matter concerned a mortal sin, and she could not have passed beyond that particular toll house if this great spiritual father of hers had not intervened to deliver her, to save it. The more self-centeredness we have, the more readily we pass judgment. That is why we have to be careful about what we say and what we think. When someone keeps a careful mouth and avoids judging at any cost with every effort, that very thing is a sign. It is proof of a soul that is saved so long as they can keep control of the tongue and the thoughts. From this, it becomes perfectly clear that this person is truly upright. The more a person keeps silent, the more securely he protects himself. And it is a great help to a soul when it prevents condemnation from taking place. It also does a very great good to one's neighbor. On another occasion, I told you about an incident in the life of St. John the Merciful, Patriarch of Alexandria. This saint condemned no one. People would come and tell him many things about monks and others, but he condemned no one. He had learned from personal experience, and from that time onward he guarded himself very carefully. Once, a very devout monk went down to Alexandria on some business for his monastery. While he was waiting at a hotel, that is, at an inn, a young woman approached him. She tugged at his cassock and said, "Save me." He was startled. "What do you want from me?" she said. "I want to be saved. I have just escaped from the devil's nets. Save me. Take me and bring me to a monastery." What was he to do? He wondered whether, because of the scandal it might cause, he should send her away, or whether he should take her to a monastery so that she might be saved. He did not know what to do. Finally, he prayed and said, "I will try to save her, and may God help me." He took her with him and tried to find a monastery. As they walked along together, they found an abandoned child lying in the road. The young woman was Jewish, and he takes the child as well. He felt sorry for it, so he took it along too. And you know how it is, how loose our tongues are, how quick we are to judge. People began saying 1,001 things, and all this talk made the rounds, and it reached the patriarch as well. The patriarch, without looking into the matter at all, takes him and locks him up in the cellar. As for the monk, he took the little girl to a monastery, saw that she was safely settled there, and went on his way. That night, when the saint had gone to sleep, he saw the monk in his sleep, and the monk bared his back to him and said, "Does it give you pleasure, Father, the beating you gave me?" The moment he woke up, he realized he had done something wrong, that he'd made a mistake. He calls his deacon and says to him, "Go and bring me the monk from downstairs, from the holding cell." The deacon brings him up. "Come, my child, just show me your back for a moment." When the monk removed his garment, the patriarch discovered that he was a eunuch. At once he said to him, "Forgive me, my child, I was wrong." The monk replied, "Yes, you are a saint, but you are also human." From that time onward, the patriarch said, "Never again will I accept a slanderous accusation from anyone against a man who wears the cassock." Word spread that the saint condemned no one. Then a very resolute monk said, "I will try to see whether he really will judge." He went down to Alexandria and worked at the docks. Then he began visiting houses of ill repute, and he said that he was sinning, and so forth. News immediately reached the patriarch that a monk was not guarding his conduct. But the patriarch told them, "Judge nothing before the Lord comes and reveals what is hidden in men, the secrets of their hearts. Judge no one." "But, Your Eminence," the priest would say, "he is dragging the monastic cassock through the mud." "He is bringing down the dignity of monasticism," they said, and so forth. I said, "No, judge no one," he replied. They were perplexed by the patriarch and by his way of thinking. The monk continued to test the patriarch through this way of life. Yet he was not merely putting the patriarch to the test. At the same time, God was also bringing souls to the Lord. When he went to those houses, he would give them the money he had earned from his work, you see, and say to the woman there, "Tonight we are going to keep vigil." After giving her the money, she would see the monk kneel, weep, pray, and read. Little by little, once he had awakened reverence and trust within her, he would begin to sow the seed of the gospel and of salvation. And many sinful souls came to faith and changed their lives. They left those houses of sin. Some became nuns, while others began to live chastely and married. and he made them swear, "You must not tell anyone anything." They kept their oath and said nothing about the virtue of this holy man, which God alone knew. Then one day, as he was coming down the stairs from such a house, a young man of that sort was going up. He slapped the monk, whose name was Vitalios, and said to him, "How long, you wretched man, will you go on deceiving people and living in debauchery?" And so he struck the monk. The holy man said to him, "The time will come, you wretched man, when this slap will be returned to you, and all Alexandria will hear of it." Indeed, after some time, the saint understood that his end was near. He rose and went outside the city, where he had a small hut made of grass. He went there, crossed his hands in the manner of the saints, and ended his earthly life. When this holy man fell asleep in the Lord, a tremendous sound was heard like the crack of a slap. The young man himself received that slap and heard a voice saying to him, "Receive the slap that the monk Vitalio sends you." At the blow, he became possessed by a demon and ran through the city crying out, "Vitalios is a saint, and Vitalios has fallen asleep outside the city." As he ran about spreading the news, he came to the monk's hut. The people also hurried there to see what had happened because, as you can well understand, during all the time Vitalios had lived there, there had been a great deal of gossip about him. The people gathered, the clergy gathered, and so did the sinful women who had abandoned their former lives and become chaste and repentant. They cried aloud and recounted the spiritual life he had lived secretly in their presence, and how he had been the reason they returned to God through metanoia, through repentance. Then the news reached St. John, the patriarch. The patriarch, now vindicated, went down with the clergy to the hut and venerated the holy monk. He gave him a most magnificent funeral and delivered a homily, saying, "Do you see what a snare you would have cast me into if I had listened to you, if I had listened to your slander?" Moreover, St. John punished the priests who had slandered the holy monk by suspending them for 3 years. They were not to celebrate the divine liturgy for 3 years. This is a very vivid and powerful example, and if we are to be saved, if we are to escape the dreadful sin of condemning others, we must be extremely careful about what we say and what we think, because speech begins first in thought, and the spoken word does not simply remain as it is. Once it leaves the mouth, the word takes on flesh. It takes on bones and flesh and becomes a living reality, a sinful reality. Another monk once heard something about a certain man and said, "Oh, so even he is still sinning." A little later, an angel came holding the soul of the man whom the monk had condemned and said to him, "Judge," for he called the monk a judge, "decide where I am to take this soul, to hell or to paradise." The monk realized his error, that he had passed judgment, and said, "I have sinned. Forgive me, I was wrong." This makes it perfectly clear that when we judge someone, we take the judge's seat and pronounce a verdict. Consider, then, what a grave error it is to place ourselves in the position of deciding whether another person is worthy of salvation or not. A humble person does not open his mouth to speak about another person. Why not? Because he thinks about his own faults. He sees the sack before him, filled with his own many sins. But when he puts that sack, full as it is, behind his back, and sets his brother's sack before him, with its few sins, then he will judge them. That is why we must not look at our brother's few faults, the speck, but at the beam in our own eye. That beam is our own personal sins and our own acts of carelessness. Who is there who has not sinned? Who has not been wounded, who is not sick, when we go to a hospital? There we see many people, and each one has an illness of his own. But what we notice is that no one condemns another for being ill. Each person is concerned with his own pain and with how he may recover. He knows that illness is part of the human condition, and we never see a sick person blaming a fellow patient for his illness. We feel compassion for the other person and suffer alongside him. Indeed, many people come to love one another deeply there, upon the bed of suffering. If we regarded ourselves in this way, as spiritually sick, and each of us attended to our own condition, we would never open our mouth to speak about another person. Saint Ephrem teaches us about this by using the example of a school. All the children have their own lesson before them. No child will have to answer for whether a classmate studied or did not study. Each one attends to his own lesson, his own paper, and how he will recite the lesson to the teacher. So here too, each of us should look at our own paper, our own record of offenses. We should examine it for sins and wipe them away. If we judge our neighbor, we will not be justified. And this sin is committed so casually, I mean so very easily, in the blink of an eye. We can cast out so many bitter words and entertain so many thoughts about our neighbor that the extent of the sin is beyond measure. So many thoughts pass through our minds, even while we are in the church and during the divine liturgy. How many things the devil brings into our minds? Why does he bring them? So that the nous, the spiritual intellect, will become occupied with these thoughts and be defiled by them, and so that we will not pay attention to the divine liturgy. He brings countless thoughts about other people, curiosity about what this person or that person is wearing, and about what the priest or the chanter is doing. What will save us is watchfulness, what the fathers call nepsis. And what does nepsis mean? To be watchful, to be sober, means to pay attention, to stay awake and keep vigil, to keep a lookout, to stand guard. We must set a guard over our nous. We must establish attentiveness, like a guard who does not allow enemies to enter. Every logismos, every intrusive thought that is not from God is our enemy. Every thought that is not good comes from the devil. The fathers say that a single thought can raise us up to heaven, and a single thought can bring us down into the depths of hell, all through one logismos, one intrusive thought. By our logismoi, our thoughts, we either become better or become worthless. The fathers also say, when the nous turns away from theoria, the divine vision of God, it becomes either brutish or savage. If a person's nous turns away from the remembrance of God, if it does not dwell upon the name of Christ, does not think of God, and does not have the fear of God within it, it will end up either in sins of the flesh or in anger and egotism. The opposite happens when we guard our nous and know how to fight against the logismoi, the intrusive thoughts. All sins begin with the logismoi. If we direct our thoughts properly, there is no occasion for sin. If a person's nerves are severed with a razor, the body becomes completely paralyzed, and there is no possibility of moving any limb. In the same way, when the logismoi are cut off through nepsis, there is no occasion for sin. We are kept from sinning altogether. No bodily member can move towards sin, unless the movement first begins within us. The shipwreck first takes place within us, and only afterward do we suffer the outward disaster. We must therefore practice nepsis over the nous and the imagination, because there is no logismos that does not begin with some image, a person, an object, a scene, or something from the past. Something enters the imagination, and from there the thought, the logismos, gets going. Of course, this is when we have what we call watchfulness, nepsis, and alertness, a wakeful, sober attention. So when we see an image, a person, something that stirs us, let us be aware of this. A corresponding logismos, an intrusive thought, will spring up, and that thought carries its own particular pleasure. Pleasure. It has its own particular pleasure. Let us say that an intrusive thought comes to me about killing someone. It will bring before my imagination all the things that person supposedly did to me. He did this and that. He killed my brother, insulted me, deceived me, made us poor, and so on. Then the image of that person appears before me. If we do not drive it away immediately and say, "This is not real, what I am thinking has no basis," then this is sin. If I do not reject it and pray at once, but instead keep that person's image within me, a desire for revenge will arise. Revenge contains a kind of pleasure and gratification. Even someone who kills another person does so with pleasure, but it is an inhuman beast-like pleasure. Therefore, a person must immediately cast away the image of that man and say, "I must not dwell on him, because I may become angry and think evil against him. This is how I must drive him from my thoughts." I make an effort to erase his image from my imagination. The devil tries to paint it there as vividly as possible, while I, through watchful attention and prayer, try to erase it. At the same time, I call upon the name of Christ, my Lord Jesus Christ. This effort itself begins a struggle, and if we persevere, the image in our imagination will eventually recede. But if we simply leave it there and offer no corresponding resistance, if the devil exerts 100 degrees of force and I exert only 50, I will suffer a loss of 50 degrees, and the image will continue developing within my thought. Then it will work like a germ within us, and anger and wrath will arise. At that moment, the devil will remind us of all the evil that person has done to us. Our rage and desire for revenge will begin to boil over. Finally, if a person yields to all these thoughts, he will reach the point of consenting to lie in wait for the other man and kill him. The other passions work in exactly the same way, each with its own images and its own pleasures. Therefore, if we wish to be freed from sins of thought and speech, we must be extremely careful not to admit images of people, things or scenes from either the past or the present. This is what the watchful fathers of the desert teach us. With a little effort directed toward our thoughts and imagination, we escape every kind of sin. But because we do not guard the imaginative faculty of the nous, the spiritual intellect, we fall into all kinds of dreadful deeds. If you wish, observe this for yourselves and put it into practice. When an evil thought comes, let it remain and see where it leads you, then drive it away and see how you are set free. Peace enters your soul. Therefore, if we set our thoughts right, no sins will come from the tongue. When the tongue does not sin, peace comes to the human soul and heart. When a person keeps silent, Pentho's mourning for sin comes to him. I do not mean the mourning we experience when someone dies and we grieve for them. Not that kind of mourning. It is neither spiritually useful nor edifying. I mean the Pentho's born from the silence of the lips and the strangling of evil thoughts. When we close our imagination and our mouth and pray inwardly, joyful Pentho's comes. It is a mourning that has joy in its depths, and its fruit is tears. Those tears wash the garment of the soul, and the soul feels a spiritual freshness. Just as a weary person feels refreshed after bathing, putting on clean clothes, and resting, so too does the soul feel when it mourns and weeps over its sins. Then it experiences this great joy within itself. In precisely this way, the imagination, the nous, the heart, and the body are cleansed. Altogether, they become pure and genuine before God, and our prayer acquires a corresponding boldness before Him. And once again, I return to what I said at the beginning. We must take care not to judge one another. It is a very grave sin and a transgression of the gospel. If we do not judge, then, according to the word of Christ, we will not be judged. I will give one final example, and then I will finish. There was once a monk who was negligent. He did not struggle as much as he should have. He neglected his canon, his rule of prayer. He did not rise at night for the vigil, and there were other such failings. But he tried never to judge any brother. When his end came, the brothers gathered around him to see how he would die, so that they might be edified by something they witnessed. They knew that he had been negligent in his duties, but when they saw him joyful, utterly peaceful and serene, they were astonished and asked him, "Forgive us, brother. We know that you were negligent. How is it, then, that we now see you departing with such joy?" How he would go to meet Christ. "Yes, indeed, my brothers, it is just as you say. I was very slothful and negligent, as those of you who lived close to me know. But I tried to keep one saying of Christ, 'Judge not, that you be not judged.' I never allowed myself, either in thought or in word, to condemn any of my brothers, and if some small offense did occur, I made sure, before the sun went down, to make a prostration before him and ask his forgiveness. Then I could go to sleep in peace. And I believe that, since I did not judge, I will not be judged. The word of Christ never fails. The word of Christ is a decree, and that decree has already been given concerning those who do not judge. Therefore, I will not be judged. I believe it." Then the brothers were amazed at the great assurance he possessed and said, "Brother, you found the path to salvation very easily. Let us do the same and keep watch over ourselves. Then, when the time comes for us to depart from this world for the next, we will not suffer anxiety or uncertainty about our salvation. Our conscience will bear witness to the truth. Since we have not judged, we will not be judged. Thank you."